Welcome. This is Phil Terry. Welcome to tonight's Reading Odyssey and Darwin Facebook call with Richard Milner. We're very pleased tonight to have Richard Milner with us. Richard Milner is an associate in anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History, a contributing editor at Natural History Magazine, a fellow of the Linnaean Society of London. He's written three award-winning books on evolution. He's published articles in Scientific American and other science magazines. He's been featured on the History, Discovery, and Animal Planet channels, as well as BBC Two and Nova. He's performed his one-man musical, Charles Darwin Live and in Concert, in the United States, in the UK, Germany, Australia, and in Darwin's beloved Galapagos Islands. We're really lucky to have him here with us tonight to talk about his new book, Darwin's Universe, Evolution from A to Z. And I really love this book. And Ian Tattersall at the American Museum of Natural History said about this book, which I thought was a terrific quote and really summed it up well, "This is no staid, humorless encyclopedia of natural history and evolution. Rather, it is a joyous romp through a world inhabited by as eccentric and absorbing a cast of characters as was ever brought together between end papers." I couldn't agree more. I love this book. It is joyous. I do recommend you go out and get it. It's a terrific gift, and everyone should have it on their coffee table, as one of the Darwin Facebook members mentioned on the website recently. And Richard's been a supporter of ours and what we're doing since we first met him in the spring. So please join me in welcoming the wonderful, the witty, the wise, Richard Milner.
Oh, Richard, all of thank us, you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Richard is, just to remind everyone, you and I will talk for about 30 minutes and then open it up to Q&A. Have your browsers ready because Richard will want to show you some things on his book website as well as his musical site, perhaps some video clips. We may do some singing tonight. It's going to be a lot of fun. Let's get started. Richard, you've written a number of books. You know, you've edited Natural History Magazine, as I said, Scientific American. Why did you decide to do this book, this wondrous, funny, irreverent encyclopedia of Darwin's universe?
You know, this started many years ago. I did a predecessor to this book called The Encyclopedia of Evolution. And yeah. The predecessor of those was written by a man, a friend of mine, who wrote the Encyclopedia of Crime, the Encyclopedia of the Mafia. And I was so enamored with the way he took a reference book format and made it into an entertainment that could be both authoritative and entertaining. And each of his entries were little stories. They weren't just entries. They were funny, or they were ironic, or they could grab you. And I wondered if you could do that for science. So I did it the first time. And I think I've learned more since the first book. Some of you may know the Encyclopedia of Evolution. But also I wanted control of the pictures, which I finally got from University of California Press. And so I was able to put in about 400 wonderful pictures that I searched the world for. So I'm also art director as well as the author of the book. And it just really represents my life's work in one place, and I'm very happy with it.
You mentioned 400 pictures. I want to share one of my favorite cartoons. It's on page 21 for those of you who have the book in front of you. You see that in the first panel, you see two prehistoric men, maybe cavemen, kind of hanging out around a rock. And one says, "If man evolved from the ape, how come there are still apes around?" And then in the next panel,
the other guy says, "Well, some of them were given choices." That's a cartoon from BC from the late Johnny Hart, who generously had given me permission to use that. But that's one of the common questions. Steve Gould used to love that question because it shows a fundamental misunderstanding of how evolution works. You don't necessarily
clarify that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you don't keep all the ancestral forms hanging around. And you don't keep, and the general notion of what is a transitional form, it's not something halfway between a chimpanzee and a human, but they both go back to a common ancestor. And that's the thing Darwin was trying to show, that there's a branching bush, there's a tree of life, and we share common descent.
Yeah.
Now we have more of these critters that are on this line than we've ever seen before. Just in the last 10 or 15 years, we have about 20 hominines showed up from a time depth starting at 8 million years ago with the Tumai skull, which I've got in the book, Sahelanthropus, which was a huge discovery just a few years ago. And then there are all these collaterals and side branches. You know, the older notion was that it was like a ladder leading up to man, leading up to Homo sapiens. And we now see, as Steve Gould used to say, that we are just the lone surviving twig of a branch that went out in many directions. Now, if you look at other animals that have had what we call a radiation, that is a branching, you don't think they're all leading up to the present species. For example, whales have radiated. There are, I don't know how many hundred species of whales, rodents, antelopes. But if all the other antelopes died but one species, we wouldn't say they were all leading up to the impala, or we wouldn't say that, you know, there was a process of becoming mooseness, becoming you know, the ultimate rodent. I mean, I believe in what Gould used to teach, the contingent history. That is, at every branch, there's a matter of chance, luck, and skill, and it's contingent history. It's got its twists and its turns that are not repeatable and are not leading up to anything. That's very hard for people to accept. We want to believe that everything led up to us.
Yeah. So let's talk about, there's so many stories in this book, Richard. And I do want to say one thing. We have a call tonight that is a mixed audience. Some of the folks with us are scientists. Some of the folks haven't necessarily thought about evolution since high school, maybe 30 years ago, if they were taught it in high school. So I did want to say to the scientists who are in the crowd, during the Q&A session, I do encourage you to ask more technical questions. I like novices to hear how scientists talk, but I also am going to take the novice questions or sort of the basic questions probably first. So as Richard's speaking, remember, send me an email, pterrycreativegood.com, with any questions. So, Richard, there are so many stories in this book. And you really do trace out Darwin's universe. What are some of your favorite stories? For example...
Well, I'll tell you a couple of my favorite stories, but first let me make this point. I called the book Darwin's Universe because that's kind of a tag and an icon. And what it really is the history of natural history, the study. This is an enormous human quest, scientific and philosophical and religious. And in so many ways, we want to know who we are and how we got here and where we came from. So I love the highways and byways. I love Mary Anning, the first woman to find a plesiosaur and had to give it to the men geologists because women weren't allowed in the geological society. I like the dinosaur diggers, the gorilla watchers, the flower breeders, the ship's captains, the explorers. So when I say Darwin's universe, I am talking about this immense enterprise involving thousands of people both before Darwin and after Darwin. And before I get to some of those interesting stories, which you will find in my book, which, if I may say, you could actually buy and learn more about by going to a site I've put up, darwinsuniverse.org, and you can learn more, and then you can buy the book directly from there. I have another site up called darwinlive.com, and that's more concerned with booking me for lectures and my musical shows. And I'm going to beg the indulgence of your audience by repeating that a few times during the hour. But now let's get on to the question at hand, Darwin's universe. You know, when we talked before this program, Phil, the question arose, and I'm sure somebody may ask it, but I'm going to ask it. Why do we focus so much on Darwin? I mean, would we want to make a cult of personality out of this man, like a cult of celebrity? Was he the greatest person that ever lived and so on? Well, no. He was a wonderful scientist, and he opened up a lot of doors. But when I think of Darwin, he's not only the amazing man who founded evolutionary biology, and by the way, revolutionized every field he touched, whether it was geology or paleontology or botany or zoology or animal behavior, on and on and on, taxonomy, the classification of living things. And he was trained in none of these and revolutionized every single field he touched. So that's remarkable enough. But whether Darwin's particular theories, let's say natural selection, are ultimately right or wrong or special cases, there's a much larger inspiration that we draw from focusing on Darwin. To me, he stands for the spirit of free inquiry. He stands for a curiosity about nature. He stands for the meticulous observation and collection of facts. And he stands for the eternal striving to understand what kind of creatures we are and where we came from. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of encompassing view that I like to take when we talk about Darwin's universe. Now, you want a few amusing stories? How about dinosaur doo-doo saved England from starvation?
There's been a lot of talk about that one on Facebook and Twitter, so yes, let's talk about that. How did
this was a discovery that was actually made by Darwin's great teacher and mentor, John Henslow, who, by the way, didn't believe in evolution, but he was a great naturalist. And some farmers brought to him some strange stones, and they were fossils, not as usually fossils are, carbonate of lime, but these were phosphates of lime, bone earth. And Henslow said immediately, and this is a quote, "You have found a treasure, not a gold mine, but a food mine. This bone earth, which we are at wit's end to get for our English crops, will increase immensely the food supply of England." And at the time, England was so desperate because the crops were dying. They had run out of natural fertilizers. And by the 1840s, mid-1840s, large coprolite deposits were turning up in many parts of southeast England, with Cambridge at the center. If you can imagine that such a great university is actually resting on an immense pile of crap.
Hard to imagine, Richard. Keep going.
And William Buckland, the geologist there, said, "Here we have in the remains of an extinct animal world what the salvation of England, as she has already found support from the petroleum products in her manufacturing industry." England at that time was so depleted from the constant and heavy continuous use of soil that, according to one contemporary writer, I'm reading from my book now, "Great Britain was like a ghoul searching the continents for bones to feed its agriculture, even mining the battlefields of Leipzig and Waterloo and the Crimea, digging up the bones of thousands of soldiers and shipping them to the farmers to put in their fields. Already from the catacombs of Sicily, she has carried away the skeletons of many successive generations." They were importing Egyptian mummies. I mean, this is amazing, isn't it? Well, now they had these huge coprolite deposits, and young men in the villages were able to make a decent wage on the farms. It was
very risky.
Yeah?
Just explain, go slowly over the word coprolite. That may be new for many people on the call.
Well, copros is dung. Light is they're stones. They're petrified dung of prehistoric animals, dinosaurs and others. And they have these phosphates in them, which can be fertilizer, just as actual dung can be fertilizer.
Yeah.
So the young men were now had money in their pockets, where they were so poor before working for the farmers. It was very dangerous because these coprolite pits were not properly built. They just got digging away, and they'd occasionally fall in and kill a few young men. And it was so risky and so hard to do. Then these guys had pockets full of money, so pubs sprang up by the hundreds. an alcoholic culture was spawned all over the English countryside. And here's one of the drinking songs of the Coprolite Men, which I really like. Come listen, you farmers, to what I do say. We Coprolite diggers can now have fair play. You once did us grind down, but now it's our turn, as we can get work and farm labor spurn. We are jolly young fellows that do not work fear. We can work at the fossils, have a pot of good beer. With our spade and pickaxe, we've no work to seek. We won't work for farmers for 10 bob a week. Your sons and your daughters, with all their fine clothes, at the Coprolite diggers, don't turn up your nose.
That's a great piece of
Coprolite, by the 1880s, it saved England, and then the Coprolite deposits played out. Cheaper fertilizers from abroad became available. And by 1885, the industry itself had become as extinct as the dinosaurs. And that's my Coprolite story.
Richard, one of the questions that you address in the book, and I think people are now getting a sense of flavor of the book. I mean, you're throwing in some good history, some good science, and some drinking songs, which is a terrific combination. One of the questions among many that people ask about evolutionary theory and natural selection is somehow it can't account for homosexuality. So you actually address that.
That's actually a very interesting topic, and one that's been hotly debated, and I don't think it's solved by any means. I mean, if the homosexual population doesn't directly contribute genes, then how come they reproduce and survive? There's a lot of question about it, and of course the religious fundamentalists had said with the Reverend Jerry Falwell, we come from Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And so they tried to teach people that that homosexuality was against nature. And there was a man a few years ago who collected all the information he could find about homosexuality in the animal world, a man named Bagmiel. And he wrote a book called Biological Exuberance. From lesbian seagulls that share a nest and rear chicks together to male giraffes that rub and entwine each other's necks until they get excited. Bonobos, those wonderful so-called pygmy chimpanzees, are the most sexual of apes. They're known as the make love, not war apes, because where chimpanzees solve their sexual problems by fighting, the bonobos do the reverse. They solve their aggression problems by copulating. It's quite remarkable. You know, there was one anthropologist who tries to explain, challenge Darwin's theory of sexual selection, and find other explanations for the peacock's tails and the elaborate antlers. Not sexual selection, but some kind of social selection. Maybe they're not there to attract females, this anthropologist asked, but they're badges of membership in power-holding cliques. Well, it's a very interesting question. And the wonderful Eric Idle of Monty Python wrote a song about it. And I'm just going to quote you some of the lyrics by the kind permission of Eric Idle, by the way, of whom I'm grateful to him. In the origin of species, Charles Darwin liked to say, the dressing up and showing off was purely male display. But sadly, scientifically, he led us all astray. For what he failed to notice was, these creatures are all gay. A tiny bird in Kent who's ridiculously bent, and a rutting stag who is a real deer. There are naughty big blue whales, and the sperm whale prefers males, and the dolphin is, of course, completely queer. Gay, 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 they all are madly gay. But in Victorian times, that was not the thing to say. And he goes on and on with
that. Tell us a little bit about your musical.
My own musical, Charles Darwin Live and in Concert. I've been writing songs about Darwin and evolution since I was in graduate school in the early Paleolithic. And I probably wrote the first song in this show about 40 years ago, and the most recent song last year. So it, too, is a life's work, like this book. Let's see, can I give you some of my lyrics? Well, I actually have some of the song lyrics in my book, in the back, which my publisher said, "What? You're putting your song lyrics in the back of a reference book? Are you mad?" I said, "Listen, I got fans."
You said, "Yes, I am." Thank you very much.
It's illustrated too. I'll give you two of my favorites. I don't know if I'll do the whole things, but I'll do some of them. Of course, without music, and I've got these all orchestrated. I have a CD you can get on my site, darwinlive.com. Thomas Henry Huxley, Darwin's great champion and friend, and the grandfather of Aldous Huxley, the novelist, a great intellectual who went out and fought for Darwin's ideas. He was known as Darwin's bulldog. Because, by the way, Darwin hated to speak in public. He hated debate. He was always very, very kind to people with opposing views. And Huxley would love to fight them, and he loved to fight the churchmen and so on. But when Huxley first read The Origin of Species in 1859, he wrote in his autobiography, "How extremely stupid not to have thought of that myself." And I thought, well, there's a song cue if ever I heard one. See, I look at the history of science for song cues, so I have Huxley saying, of course, it must be so. He's kind of a Rex Harrison kind of very flamboyant character. "I should have seen it long ago. 'Twas adaptive radiation that produced the mighty whale. His hands have grown to flippers, and he has a fishy tail. Selection's made him streamline for his liquid habitat. Why didn't I think of that? There was an ancient mammal that could hop and leap around, but with webbing twixt his fingers, he could fly right off the ground. And so this mousy creature evolved into a bat. Why didn't I think of that? There are fossils in the ground, protozoa in the sea. All these unrelated facts made a monkey out of me. And now I see how species were selectively defined. How could I have been so ruddy blind? There was an ancient monkey with a long and curly tail. This ape evolved into a man. He's teaching now at Yale. A chimp could pass for upper class in gloves and a cravat. Why didn't I think of that?" And so on.
It's great.
Are you ready for another
great.
One?
Great. Well, here's what I want to do, actually.
Go on.
I want to switch gears and come back to another song a little bit later. But one of the...
What do you want to talk about? Or are you getting emails and calls that you want me to answer yet?
Not yet, but thank you for reminding me to tell people to email in your questions and thoughts. PTerry@creativegood.com. One of the articles you edited in Natural History Magazine several years ago that I read and loved was about ghost species. It's such a terrific concept. Can you talk a little bit about that? It's in your universe. It's in your encyclopedia. Tell us what that is.
Yes, well, the ghost species, when we look at a species today, and there's something about it that doesn't make sense unless you try to relate it to the environment in which it evolved. And it may have co-evolved with some other species that is now extinct. And in some cases, we can actually figure out what these are. Now, I'll tell you how I start the section on ghost species in my book is with you remember the movie Oh God with 1977 with George Burns and John Denver? Well, John Denver marvels that everything in nature is perfect. "Oh, I made some mistakes," replies George Burns as God, puffing on his cigar. "For instance, the avocado. I made the pit too big."
That's for sure.
Well, but see, now, if you want to look at the evolutionary reason for the apparently oversized, tough-shelled avocado seed, this could well be a plant that was once dispersed by giant ground sloths and the gomphotheres, a kind of extinct elephant, and the hippo-like toxodon that gulped down the fleshy fruits whole and then carried them miles away while these seeds were sort of opened up and eaten away by their powerful digestive juices. No living North American mammals have sufficiently large guts to do that job. There are so many.
The belief is that there was a mammal at one time that has gone extinct, but the avocado is the ghost species because it's still here, but it is not, you know, it's missing its co-evolution partner, essentially, right?
And it has to be artificially reproduced.
Yeah.
Because there's no animals that will disperse it. I'll give you some examples. Mango, papaya, tamarind, Osage orange, Kentucky coffee tree, gourd, all appear to have catered to fruit-loving animals that once dispersed their seeds. And they only prosper today because humans and their domestic animals now spread the seeds. There's something I pass almost every day when I go through the park. It's called a honey locust tree. Many parks in cities have honey locust trees, and they have these big pods at the top that you see, and they drop down with the seed pods. But the tree also evolved formidable thorns on its trunk and lower branches. And I have a picture in the book from Central Park of one of these honey locust trees. And it's just covered with these enormous thorns. You cannot get near this tree. Well, a good hypothesis is that elephants could browse for seed pods with their trunks, meaning mastodons, but they were prevented from stripping bark, which would kill the trees. Mm. They're very sturdy and drought-resistant. They're commonly planted in city parks. But now they're planting the male trees, which are podless and thornless. And the older plantings include some of the female trees with their seed pods and their armor, just in case any mastodon should return to eat them. So despite George Burns's theological apology, the avocado was not the product of a divine mistake. The structure of the fruits and the seed coats and the armaments seem to be proclaiming that they're adapted for life in a vanished world.
Mm. Talk a little bit about the ape language controversy. You have a lot in their book on that, and I think it's of never-ending interest for us hominids.
Yes, but, you know, there are many books that deal with the ape language controversy, and I have dealt with it, but I don't think it's very unique to my book, Darwin's Universe. I've covered it, but I prefer to talk about things I have that nobody else has, if I may.
All right. Sure.
For instance, the Fox Farm Experiment, which I love, which is in the book. We know genetically that our dogs are descendants of wolves. They do not come, for example, from foxes, and Darwin knew this. In Russia, they used to raise foxes for their furs in fox farms. And when the humans would go in there to clean them and feed them, the foxes were nasty, and they'd bite the hand that fed them. So what happens is they kill first the nasty ones, and they keep around the nicer ones that aren't going to bite them. And so this is a process of artificial selection. And there were some changes in the foxes. And in 1959, a Russian geneticist named Belyayev decided to take over a fox farm as a genetic experiment. And they started with 130 silver foxes, caged for generations, already tamer than wild foxes, but only those that earned the very highest tameness rating. They wagged their tails, they whined, they let themselves be petted, they were allowed to breed, and the others were not. Well, after 30 or 35 generations, the foxes didn't just act like dogs, they also began to look more like dogs and other domestic mammals. They had shorter curly tails, floppy ears, piebald colored fur. Their skulls got smaller, the snouts got broader. How is it that simply selecting for particular behavior can cause all these physical changes? Well, the finger seems to point at hormones and other neurochemicals that control aggression and tameness, but also, along with that, it selects for particular levels of neurochemicals, involves the retention of juvenile traits in an adult. This is a process called neoteny. So the foxes essentially became a fox-derived dog rather than a wolf-derived dog. And I have a picture one in my book. They're just, isn't that a wonderful thing that this could happen?
Great. Yes. Yeah. There's so much in evolutionary biology that is hard to understand, hard to predict, but very exciting and curious. What other stories do you have that you like that are unique to your book or that you particularly like sharing?
Well, I can just briefly talk about the Iguanodon dinner, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
Celebrate New Year's Eve in 1853. When they first did the first reconstructions of dinosaurs in England, the anatomist Richard Owen and the artist Benjamin Waterhouse Hawkins. And by the way, one of the things I do in the book is I talk about the importance of art in shaping science. People like Charles R. Knight, which is the subject of my next book, by the way. Charles R. Knight, the father of paleo art, the man who essentially invented our image of a dinosaur. And he's in here, but I'm going to do a whole book on him next year with his granddaughter.
Hmm.
First one who, for Harry Abrams' art book company, but the first reconstructions were these giant models, and they can still be seen on the site of the former Crystal Palace in South London, a place called Sydenham. And so all the scientists gathered in the belly of this giant iguanodon statue to sort of open the park, the first dinosaur theme park. And that was the iguanodon dinner, a life-size iguanodon constructed of metal and concrete. And the scientists sang a song, "The jolly old beast is not deceased. There's life in him again. Roar!" So you can see the picture of all these scientists sitting in the iguanodon. That's just one of the so many delightful stories. You know,
that's page 239 for those of you who have the book in front of you, by the way. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, that would be on page 239. Of Darwin's Universe, available from darwinsuniverse.org, by the way, for those of you joining late. One of my favorite stories is one that I discovered myself. Nobody had this story, and I published it in Scientific American about 10 or 12 years ago. And it's a story of a trial that took place in England in 1876. It was a trial of a psychic who claimed that his wife's ghost would answer your questions by writing on a slate. You would go into a seance room, pay your money, ask your question, and the ghost writing would appear. Well, Darwin absolutely detested phony frauds, con men who were posing as psychics and spiritualists. He called them all imposters. And having lost his darling 10-year-old daughter, Annie, the thought that anybody would prey on the grief of bereaved parents for money to talk to the dead, he just thought this was the lowest of the low, and he secretly wrote letters to newspapers trying to expose these guys. And when they did get exposed, they went to jail. Not like today, where people talk to the dead, we give them their own national television shows. you may be aware of this, or maybe not, but they do. Alfred Russel Wallace, Darwin's friendly rival, a very brilliant naturalist who's often underrated and overlooked, Darwin's junior partner in the discovery of natural selection, was a mystic and a staunch believer in spiritualism. And he believed that these psychics who looked him in the eye and said that it was all for real, he couldn't believe they were lying in his face. He thought they were investigating the paranormal. And so I traced this case that took place in 1876 where one of Thomas Huxley's students named Ray Lankester, and he was in his 20s, later became director of the British Museum of Natural History. But in his 20s, he wants to impress his heroes, Darwin and Huxley. He goes to a seance. He snatches the slate in the dark away from the psychic and says, "Ah, there was writing on it before I have even asked my question. You are a fraud. You are an imposter. I am going to haul you into court and prosecute you." Well, in those days, in England, and I don't know, maybe still today, you paid the cost of the prosecution if you charged somebody, not the state. You paid. And he didn't have much money. And then I found it a very obscure memoir that Darwin had secretly contributed money to the cost of the prosecution because he considered it, quote, a public benefit. Now, I followed the trail of this for 14 years because the story was scattered. It wasn't in any biographies. Nobody knew the story. I pieced it together. I got transcripts of the trial out of the old newspapers. And to my amazement and joy, I find that the star witness for the defense was Alfred Russel Wallace, standing up for the integrity of the psychic, placing Darwin and Wallace, the two greatest naturalists of the 19th century, at opposite sides of a bizarre courtroom trial where a ghost went on trial. And in fact, it was two naturalists taking opposite sides when the supernatural went on trial. I love this story, and I've got it in the book.
Wow, that is a great story. We have
a number
of questions.
Probably one of my favorites. And right near it, I have a section on spiritualism where, now here I have a full page from the New York Times, and it says, get this, Sunday, December 14th, 1913, the New York Times, headline, "Life After Death Declared Proved by Evolution." And here comes a series of skulls, the La Chapelle aux Saints, the Heidelberg Man, the Pithecanthropus, and so on, including the Piltdown, which was, of course, a fraudulent one that got thrown into the game by some hoaxers. "Prominent scientist holds that man's ascent from apes means an incessant evolutionary process for humanity not stopped by the grave and proves the existence of a supreme being." Now, there is using a series of hominid skulls in the New York Times to prove the existence of a supreme being. And I don't even remember the guy's name. It was a professor at Columbia who made this startling announcement. But it shows you that, you know, at various points in our culture and in our society, people have taken up evolution to prove almost anything they wanted. And when people write that, you know, Darwin was responsible for capitalism, for exploitation, for survival of the fittest in economic terms, for Nazi Germany exterminating the inferior races, you know, George Bernard Shaw said that Darwin had the good fortune to be adopted by anyone who had an axe to grind. But so has Jesus, for that matter. You can quote, you know, the devil can quote scripture, as we know. So,
Richard.
The interesting thing to me is to watch the fads and fallacies as they pass, and some of them repeat and repeat and repeat. Some of the arguments that go on today, why people who think they just thought them up 10 minutes ago, were argued first and so much better in the 19th century. And I've taken the writings of the 19th century people and serve them up for a new generation so you can see where these ideas come from and often better expressed than in the writings of some of our contemporaries that are selling books.
Richard, we have a number of questions that have come in. And
okay.
Just to your last point, it is one of the lovely things about your book, in fact, is just what you're saying, the 19th century writing and the 19th century drawings as well. But Susan Hedden has written in. She has thousands of followers on Twitter, where she's known as Book Nibber. She's a librarian. She says she likes what she sees and hears. She's going to ask that your book be added to the collection at the library where she works, and she has a question for you. She wants to know if you have an entry for Hardy's Aquatic Theory of Evolution. She just watched a video of Elaine Morgan, who did a great job explaining the theory.
Yeah. The predecessor of this book, the Encyclopedia of Evolution that I published in 1990, has a whole section on Elaine Morgan and the aquatic ape theory.
Yeah.
And I did go into it, but I left it out of this book because I brought in so many new things here. I have 100 new entries and hundreds of new pictures, and certain things had to go. And that theory really hasn't held up. It's an interesting curiosity, and it's very imaginative, and Elaine Morgan is a very charismatic person. But really, it's unsupported by the bulk of scientific evidence, and I can't go into it in detail. There are people who have gone into it on the web. You can find it. We never were exclusively a swimming ape as far as mainstream science is concerned, and I think that idea was considered and then rejected. It's funny. People sometimes ask me, Richard, what's your theory of evolution? And I say, I don't have one. And they go, come on, everybody that writes on this subject has to have a theory. Well, no. I'm content with really just looking at what everybody has done and tried to do and what they've said, and I've tried to present it all fairly and accurately and entertainingly. And I don't have enough hubris to think that I can solve these riddles. You know, the main thing I come out with, and people say, "Oh, you know so much." Well, I don't. I mean, I know the history, but I don't know any more than anybody else does how we got here. I mean, and how the universe got here. I know the science of it, but these are great mysteries, and Darwin well knew that. He said, "You want to know the plan of God?" He said, "A dog might as well try to understand the mind of Newton." But let every man hope and believe as he can. Darwin was very gentle, you know. He didn't want to offend people's religious sensibilities. If that was what was giving them hope and comfort, he was not going to be a Richard Dawkins and trash them and so on. I want to read you just for a second, if I may, what Huxley said at Darwin's funeral in the eulogy at the end, which I think is so telling about the personality of Darwin. As a real gentleman, Huxley said he appreciated that notwithstanding Darwin's gentility and conventional lifestyle, he had managed to reshape and revolutionize Western thought. And here's what Huxley said. He delivered a thought-reversing doctrine to mankind with as little disturbance as possible to the deeply rooted sentiments of the age. None have fought better, and none have been more fortunate than Charles Darwin. He found a great truth and lived long enough to see it, chiefly by his own efforts, irrefragably established in science, inseparably incorporated with the common thoughts of men. What shall a man desire more than this?
They're great words. And Kathy Cranston actually writes in a related question. Who do you think were the most significant heirs to Darwin after his death, i.e. in the next generation?
Well, let's see, in the next generation after Darwin. Well, there were a couple of people that were students of his that we don't hear much about these days. For example, Ray Lankester, who I just spoke about. He not only ran the British Museum, but he was responsible for helping bring in the ideas of genetics, of Weismann, and very early genetics, and trying to link it up with Darwin. And then, of course, the whole game fell to the population geneticists, Fisher and Haldane and others, who tried to work out the mathematics of evolution in populations, populational genetics. In other words, one of the great contributions of Darwin, not entirely well appreciated, is that he didn't talk about the evolution of individuals. I mean, he was or species. He was talking about changes in populations. He was talking about variety. Where other people had seen types and ladders, he saw bushes and varieties in populations. I mean, all zebras may look alike to us, but after Darwin studied barnacles for 8 years, he knew that there's tremendous variation among individuals of a species, and that is the raw material on which evolution works. And so his heirs were people who studied variation and who quantified it. And there's a long list of them. There was a British school with Haldane and Maynard Smith and others. And there was an American, and Huxley was earlier. And then there was an American school, people like Henry Fairfield Osborne of the American Museum of Natural History, and others here. There was kind of a split between the British and the Americans, where the British sort of adhered to Darwin's idea that it all had to do with adaptation. And the Americans, particularly my late dear friend Stephen Jay Gould, questioned that you can't just use adaptation as a mantra for everything. If you think something, you see a structure, you don't know what it is, what it's for. Oh, well, it must have evolved because it served a purpose as such and such. No. You got to demonstrate what the adaptation was. You can't assume everything was an adaptation. There's a lot of chance. I mean, as Gould used to say, the dinosaurs could be as well adapted as they wanted to. And they were perfectly well adapted for 140 million years until something, maybe giant meteors came, changed the whole climate of the Earth, wiped them out overnight, and gave the mammals a chance to radiate and fill the niches. So you've got to consider the twists and turns and dumb luck, and it's a meandering path.
There's a lot more questions coming in, Richard. Let me share a couple with you. Kendall Crolius, who's actually the producer of the Darwin Lecture Series, is following the anniversary campaign, doing terrific work. She wants to know, would Darwin be surprised that his theory is still controversial? What do you think?
Yes, I think he would, in a certain sense. In the first place, he would not have been able to predict genetics and the affirmation of evolution through DNA and genetics. He would not have been able to predict that, but he would have been quite delighted with it. He would not have been surprised. What would have surprised him would have been the tenacity of organized religion, which he expected to sort of gradually fade away without. He never wanted to confront it. He never wanted to make people angry. He never wanted to challenge their beliefs. But he thought there was a sort of shadow of superstition that would be gradually driven away by the light. This is an Enlightenment idea, driven away by the light of reason, the light of fact. I have in my book, it's a wonderful cartoon from the 1880s of the sort of all kinds of religionists cowering under an umbrella in the shadows while the daylight of Darwin and Voltaire and Jefferson shined down from the sun. But it didn't work out that way, did it? Not at all. I think he would have been quite amazed to see what's going on today with the culture wars and so on. He would have thought that would all be behind us by now.
Some more questions. A comment from April Posevitz, a teacher in the New York City schools, very heartening. She's really enjoying this and thinks she can use this lecture and your book as motivation for her high school students, which is great to hear. And we have a couple scientists who've written in. John Brownell asks the question, back to our earlier conversation, can you conclude anything about homosexuality in humans from that in lower animals? What is the origin of homosexuality in animals, if you have thoughts on that?
I have to conclude the origin, but you certainly can say that it's extremely widespread in the animal kingdom and across all kinds of phyletic lines. I mean, you've got every conceivable kind of sexuality in fishes and birds and insects and mammals and reptiles, on and on and on. It's just not rare, and it's very widespread, and I'm sure there are many special cases of why it arose in particular cases. In some cases, for example, there are certain birds that that are known as helpers, acorn woodpeckers, for example. They don't mate, and they don't have sex, and they help their relatives raise their eggs. I think there's a similar situation in meerkats, where you've got helpers and babysitters. I don't think there's an answer, except, let me go back to this entry in my book on biological exuberance. Now, maybe this begs the question a little, but the guy that collected all those instances of homosexuality in nature, he was so puzzled by it that he said he coined the term biological exuberance. That's the title of his book, the idea being that life just goes in all directions madly. Whatever it can possibly do, it will do. He describes 470 species, mammals and birds, that are homosexual or multisexual behavior. He's uncomfortable with a cut-and-dried solution of kin selection and marvels at nature's enigmatic abundance, the exuberance of his title. He wants us to celebrate the fact that life appears in every conceivable shape, inhabits a wide range of environments, and manifests enormous sexual diversity without human-imposed preconceptions or limitations. Now, I want to quote a delightful poem after taking his grandchildren to the zoo, the great French author Victor Hugo once expressed his own puzzled delight at the exuberance of the natural world. Listen to this. "Personally, I don't expect God to keep himself under control. Not always. You have to put up with some vibrant excesses from such a great poet and not lose your temper if the master who tinges peach blossom so subtly and arches the rainbow right over the ocean he pacifies should give us a hummingbird one day and next day a mastodon. Bad taste is one of his quirks. He likes to add dragons to chasms and maggots to sewers, to do everything on an astonishing scale." Well, that's not a scientific answer, but isn't it nice?
It is. It is. And it is a nice compliment to the notion of exuberance. Quinn O'Neill writes in, another one of our scientists in the audience today, and asks, she'd be interested to know what you think about the role of evolution in contemporary human populations. Is modern medicine preventing our own evolution by natural selection?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so. I have an arthritic hip. And without pain blockers that I'm taking, I would have fallen over the cliff by now. You got to realize that if you look back in human evolution, one of the hallmarks of human evolution from the earliest times, I'm talking even about Neanderthals, is that they care for their old people. For instance, we have Neanderthal skulls that are devoid of teeth. These guys could not have eaten if their relatives weren't feeding them. So giving care to impaired members of the society is perhaps a hallmark of a human trait, and if you want to extend that to modern medicine, that's fine. I mean, there's always these fears about how we're ruining our stock, our breeding stock. We're not thoroughbred horses, you know. And I'm very, very wary of things. That so easily leads to eugenics. Well, let's just get rid of all these people. Why give them medicine? Just, you know, let everybody die that's going to die, and it'll improve the species. Well, I don't know. I mean, the classic rejoinder is that Steinmetz, the deformed dwarf, was one of the greatest scientists that ever lived, one of the most brilliant scientists that ever lived. Another deformed dwarf, Toulouse-Lautrec, one of the greatest artists. So who's to say what's valuable and what's evolved?
Yeah. But some more questions coming in. That's great. Susan Hedden writes in again, and I want to ask this because I know you would like to spend a few minutes on this. She loves Stephen Jay Gould's work and was wondering if you could say just a few words about your old friend.
Stephen Gould and I met when we were 12 years old when I was giving a lecture on dinosaurs to a sixth grade class. And he said, "I'm interested in dinosaurs too." And we found we were the only two geeks in the school that were interested in dinosaurs. If you can believe that, a time when kids weren't interested in dinosaurs, except me and Stephen Gould. And we used to go to the Museum of Natural History. He claimed he was frightened by the Tyrannosaurus when he was 5 years old and left the museum and entered his dreams, and he decided to become a paleontologist before he even knew what the word meant. Anyone came in late, you can get my book at darwinsuniverse.org. Now, Stephen Gould was a great friend to me. He wrote me a note once. I had not seen him in 25 years, and I said, "Do you remember me?" He said, "Blood may be thicker than water, but junior high school friendships are thicker than anything." And he said, "You liked me before I was famous." And so we became friends again. And he wrote the introduction to this book. This is a posthumous essay by Gould, which was really written for the first version, the Encyclopedia of Evolution. But it still holds up, so I put it in this book. And there's a picture in the book of me and Stephen Gould, age 12, with our arms around each other. I wrote a song about him while he was still alive that goes something like this. It's to his favorite Gilbert and Sullivan song. My name is John Wellington Wells. I'm a dealer in magic and spells. And I was asked by Michael Shermer of the Skeptics at a tribute to Gould to do a song for him. And so I wrote, Stephen Jay Gould is my name, and fossils and shells are my game. Bahamian snails and how does it go? Canadian shales and Bahamian snails have brought me a measure of fame. If Darwin is your cup of tea, but you don't have a lot of time free, you don't have to look in his wearisome book. You could learn evolution from me. I could tell you a tale of a trial where Brian and Darrow once tangled. A courtroom so laden with bile, the truth got distorted and mangled. Fundamentalists shouted defiance. Darwinian textbooks must go. The Bible contains all the science a biology class needs to know. I write of cladistics and baseball statistics and dodos and mandrills and friezes and spandrels with answers provisional, branches divisional, watching them practically bifurcate fractally, and so on. He loved it, and I'm glad I wrote it while he was still alive.
Kendall Crolius writes in and asks, she'd like to know how scientists react to your musical presentations on Darwin.
Well, I love it. I've been booked all over the world. At first, they don't know, because a lot of people try to be amateur lyricists, and it's usually pretty poor. I was written up by the New York Times as being the best one out there. And I was even asked to judge a contest of Darwin songs for the New York Times. Oh, by the way, if you want to really hear me sing a Darwin song with the music and see an interview, go to YouTube and just put in Richard Milner, and you'll see the music video that the New York Times made of me.
Now, that was right around the same time as the birthday, and we were covered that same week, at the end of that week, that you were covered at the beginning of the week. That was actually one of the first times that... that I saw you, and I don't remember how we met. I think Chris Farnay reached out to you.
Thank you, Chris.
Probably on the line tonight. Great.
Can I talk about some of the upcoming things I'm doing, which is so much fun? I've been invited to join a recreation of the voyage of the HMS Beagle, a three-masted sailing ship, which is created by the Dutch National Television Network, and they're retracing the voyage of the Beagle all next year. And Sarah Darwin, the great-great-granddaughter, is going to be the narrator, and all these scientists and philosophers and performers and Darwins are going to come on the ship at various times. I'm going to be on from Rio de Janeiro to Montevideo, and I'm really looking forward to this. We're filming that in October. In November, the Linnean Society of London, where the Darwin-Wallace paper was first presented in 1858, is giving a launch party for my book, November 10th, and I will be performing my show there. And to perform my show at the Linnean Society, that is a dream come true.
So do three things. Tell us your two URLs again, and maybe can we end with a little song?
Well, let's see. Trying to think what song to do.
DarwinLive.org
is where you can see more about the book and buy the book. DarwinLive.com is where you can learn about booking my lectures and shows. Ending with a song. I have a Maurice Chevalier song based on an old poem from the 1920s.
Great.
When you were a tadpole and I was a fish in the oceans of Cambrian time, then side by side on the ebbing tide we swam through the ooze and the slime. You winked once at me and I blinked back at you as we clambered through salt marsh and fen. You good-looking creature, I just had to meet you, 'cause I loved you even then.
Terrific. Richard Milner, thank you so much. What a lovely evening. What a lovely book. Witty, wise, funny, and a great way to teach. You know, you share our passion. In fact, you're a real model for us in our attempt to help engage the general public in thinking and talking about some of these wonderful...
More than words. Celebrate Darwin in art, in music, evolution, all of it. Be human about it. Don't be dry and academic. Put on all the stops.
Excellent. Now, everyone's clapping in the background, although they're muted, so you can't hear. And I'm getting lots of emails. Send me emails with your thanks for Richard Milner. And Richard, again, thank you so much for spending this evening with the Reading Odyssey and the Darwin Facebook campaign. We're really thrilled to have you.
great pleasure to be here with you. And if your audience likes it enough, maybe we can do it again.
I would like that.